You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Gould. Award-winning historian and cartographer Rick Britton is a frequent guest on WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. In January and February of 2010, Rick presented 6 lectures in a new series entitled Characters of Central Virginia, The Famous, The Infamous, and The Undeniably Odd. The series was held at the Charlottesville Senior Center. In this podcast, Rick looks at the twists and turns of the life of a woman who claimed to be Anastasia, the heiress to the Russian monarchy. Rick follows her journey from a Berlin asylum to number 35 University Circle in Charlottesville, Virginia. Rick Britton.
The Ipatiev house sat ominously quiet in the well-to-do sector of Ekaterinburg, Siberia. Jacob Yuropsky, a small photography shop owner, paced back and forth in the dim light of the downstairs hallway. It was well past midnight, and the Fiat truck he had requisitioned still hadn't arrived. The so-called house of special purpose was easy enough to recognize. From the street, the view of the yard was blocked by a specially built wooden palisade. The Reds had even boarded up and whitewashed the windows. A small knot of Bolshevik secret police stood guard at the only entrance. Their cigarettes burned trails like fireflies in the quiet Russian night. Upstairs in the master bedroom, Tsarina Alexandra penned her diary entry for July 16th, 1918. The situation remained grim, even though their new guards were under the command of a local shopkeeper. The Tsarina herself was confined to a wheelchair. None of the family members were allowed to use the laboratory unescorted. The Bolshevik guards were constantly drunk and abusive. Despite all of this, the family still had hope and were in relatively good cheer considering the length of their captivity. Large-scale battles were raging nearby. At any moment, the White Army might break through and return all of them to their rightful places. Even though isolated, the Tsar had been brought coded information of plans for their rescue. The youngest daughter, Anastasia, always the family clown, elevated their spirits with her little antics. When the vehicle finally sputtered up the street at 1:30 a.m., Yuropsky sent word to the driver to keep the engine running. He hoped the noise would drown out any loud sounds coming from the house. Yuropsky went upstairs to fetch the Romanovs a few minutes later. When he opened the door to the girls' room, a coarse Bolshevik guard leered in over his shoulder. Dr. Eugene Botkin entered, holding a crude lamp that cast strange moving shadows about the clutter. He informed them that because of unrest in Ekaterinburg, they were being moved to the sub-basement. They would be safer there. Jacob Yuropsky stood in the hallway while the same message was delivered to Tsar Nicholas II in the other bedroom. The imperial family washed and dressed slowly. When ready, Yuropsky led them downstairs. Tsar Nicholas carried the hemophiliac Tsarevich Alexis in his arms. Alexandra, and you'll pardon me, some of these words, some of these names are a little bit difficult. Alexandra Fyodorovna, stepping slowly with her cane down the darkened stairs, led the Grand Duchesses Olga, Tatiana, Maria, and Anastasia the youngest. Anastasia Nikolaevna carried Jemmy, the family dog. Dr. Botkin and Demidova the maid followed the royal family carrying pillows for Alexis. Nicholas's valet Trupp and the cook Karatinov were the last down the steep staircase. A Bolshevik guard made sure they moved along. Outside, the night was clear and starry. The Fiat rumbled loudly, impatiently. At the bottom, Yuropsky waved the family into the dank sub-basement room. The guards had been using it as a barracks, but now even the crude pallets and bedding were missing. A high barred window and a small locked door were the only additions to the white plaster walls. "How could this be?" remarked Alexandra disdainfully. "Not even a chair? Can't we at least sit down?" Yuropsky nodded to a Bolshevik guard, and 2 chairs were brought in. While the family tried to make themselves comfortable, Yurovsky conferred quietly with the Tsar in the hallway. When Nicholas II joined his family, his ashen expression was the first warning of what was to come. Jacob Yurovsky burst into the room leading the firing squad. As the secret police loaded, he addressed the royal entourage in crisp, formal language. Your relatives have continued the offensive against the Soviet Russia. In light of this, the executive committee of the Ural Soviet has decided to execute you. The Tsar turned to his family and made the sign of the cross. The vodka-drunk secret police opened fire and continued until the room filled with acrid smoke. Each executioner had been assigned a target. Yurovsky dispatched the Tsar himself with a bullet to the brain. Dr. Bodkin sprang to protect Alexandra but landed across her legs and slid to the floor. The Tsarina herself was knocked backwards out of her chair. Alexis slumped to the stone, cold floor in a moaning heap. Anastasia stood just behind Tatiana, who was thrown back by the blast. Jemmy dropped from Anastasia's arms and they collapsed into the pile that was once the imperial family of Russia. After 3 minutes of firing, Yurovsky ordered the guards to finish the job. Intoxicated with the savagery of the moment, they fixed bayonets and stepped among the bloody, writhing forms. The Bolsheviks systematically plunged their blades into all of the bodies. Some sighed gratefully. Not all of the royal party lay prone, however. Demidova, the maid, still stood against the pockmarked plaster wall, clutching a pillow. She screamed and dodged from side to side until overwhelmed by 30 stab wounds. Yurovsky found Alexis whimpering in a puddle of his imperfect blood. He placed the muzzle of his pistol to the boy's head and pulled the trigger. Jemmy's skull was crushed with a rifle butt. Yurovsky surveyed their work. A mass of blood-stained, bullet-riddled corpses was all that remained. The neighbors in Ekaterinburg would later remark that they thought they heard gunshots in the early hours of July 17th, 1918, and perhaps a loud truck engine. On February 17th, 1920, so 2 years later, at about 9 p.m., a Sergeant Hallman of the Berlin City Police was walking his beat when he saw a young woman throw herself from the Bendler Bridge into the Landwehr Canal. He tossed off his police jacket and dove in after her. Hallman pulled the dazed woman out of the water and escorted her to police headquarters. She had nothing on her person to identify her. She had no handbag, and her coat and dress pockets were completely empty. There weren't even any labels in her clothing. When she spoke, which was seldom, it was with a strangely foreign accent. Believing her to be mentally ill, the police drove her to the Elizabeth Hospital, where she was taken in for the night. She remained there 6 weeks. Because of her unresponsiveness, the doctors felt she'd be better off at an institution. At Dahldorf Asylum, just outside of Berlin, she was admitted as Fräulein Unbekannt, Miss Unknown. A physical examination on March 30th, 1920, found her to be 5 feet, 2 inches tall, weighing 110 pounds. Her body was a mass of cuts and bruises. She was diagnosed as depressive and put into a ward with 14 other women. Miss Unknown remained at Dahldorf for just over 2 years, but sometime during her stay, she revealed to the nurses what she believed to be her true identity. She was Anastasia, she said, youngest daughter of Nicholas and Alexandra and Grand Duchess of Russia. Like some mystic survivor of a fairy tale dream, she had escaped Ekaterinburg and landed in the very real post-war Berlin. Like the details of the rest of Anastasia's life, her journey from the cellar in Ekaterinburg to the Landwehr Canal in Berlin has fascinated the world for decades. How had she escaped the firing squad? How had she made it through a Russia ripped to shreds by civil war? The bloody Bolsheviks desperately needed to be sure of her death along with that of her family, but the countryside was alive with rumors that one, perhaps even two, of the Grand Duchesses had escaped the slaughter pen. Evidence seems to show, in fact, that the Reds had hunted her. While the revolution was being fought, small pockets of monarchists clung to the hope that surviving Romanovs would one day restore their medieval traditions. Anastasia's escape, her story, as referred to by her many chroniclers, is fantastical and very difficult to sort through. The entire description of her trek was never told of a piece at one sitting or audience or to one person. Nevertheless, the main points she related are as follows. When the bodies of the imperial family were being prepared for burial, a man she called Alexander Tchaikovsky discovered that her heart was still beating. Somehow he managed to secret her into some underbrush where she remained unconscious. Alexander later returned with a few other members of his family and a friend named Shurov. Anastasia was concealed in the back of a cart and they headed west. The trip was long and arduous. They traveled by seldom used routes, bribing soldiers with Romanov jewels that had been sewn into her clothing. Miss Unknown claims she lay in the back of the jostling cart, half delirious from the pain of her many wounds. She later recalled the months-long journey as one continuous suffering nightmare. Their travels, she said, brought them to Bucharest by winter, where they lived for a while in a small cottage on the west, on a side street, Sfinti Voievoda, named for a saint. The Romanian capital at the time was swarming with refugees from the Russian turmoil. One more family of destitute peasants attracted very little notice. Anastasia was still gravely ill and remained indoors most of the time. When her fever became unbearable, the family would lay her on top of the snow in the yard. She later said that in Bucharest, she gave birth to a boy who was immediately put up for adoption. She married Alexander in a Catholic ceremony and took his name. One day he didn't come home, and Anastasia learned that he had been shot in the street. The image of her husband, her savior, in a coffin was one Anastasia would often recall. Later investigations failed to uncover records of the birth, the marriage, or the death. And I think I should tell you that when I'm saying Anastasia here, y'all don't see what it says in my text, but Anastasia is always in quotation marks, okay? Meanwhile, in Russia, the surviving Romanovs, led by the Dowager Tsarina Marie, had taken refuge on the Crimean Peninsula. As Bolshevik forces neared, they accepted the British offer of assistance and prepared their escape from Russian soil. On April 7, 1919, the contingent of 81 individuals boarded the British battleship HMS Marlborough. The 2 tons of absolute necessities they brought along with them, 2 tons, required an entire day to load. In Bucharest, having lost her rescuer, Miss Unknown said she decided to seek out her mother's sister, Princess Irene of Prussia, then residing in Berlin. The Grand Duchess claimed that once reunited with her family, she could step back out of the living hell that had temporarily taken over her life. She recounted that Shurov arranged the sale of a few precious stones, and the two set out for Berlin. They traveled mostly by night, she said, to avoid soldiers and police. Anastasia said that she and Shurov arrived in a Berlin covered with snow. The date was February 17th, 1920. Spending some of their last coins, they moved into separate rooms in a flophouse hotel. Shurov left for a short while, and when he didn't return, Miss Unknown said she grew frantic. Had he left her for good? Had he been murdered by the Reds? Lost in despair, the Grand Duchess stumbled out into the snow-covered maze of downtown Berlin. After searching aimlessly, she said she realized she had forgotten to note the name of her hotel or even the name of the street it was on. The intense suffering of 2 years had brought her to this. She was without help, without money, lost in a foreign city. Anastasia was lost, in fact, in a reality that was not hers. The black waters of the Landwehr Canal seemed inviting. "I believed I was no longer in this world," she recounted, "when I glided into the water." Miss Unknown, of course, was rescued from the brackish waters by Sergeant Hallman, but was never really rescued from the strange fantasy life she invented. The life she claimed she had lived as a teenaged Grand Duchess would forever remain the stuff of dreams, books, plays, and movies. Following her life from the asylum at Dahldorf to University Circle in Charlottesville, Virginia, is like working through a twisted, convoluted maze. Through most of her life, Anastasia was plagued by ill health and a fluctuating disposition. She also suffered through the duplicity of friends who at first saw her claims as a ticket to notoriety, but then struggled to deny that they were true. Through all of her illnesses and moods, however, she attempted to maintain her ersatz identity. Whether she was using the name Madame Tchaikovsky or Anna Anderson, her claim remained the same. She said she was Her Imperial Highness Grand Duchess Anastasia Nikolaevna of Russia, improbable survivor of a royal dynasty and rightful heiress, and this is the important part, rightful heiress to all remaining monies and holdings that had belonged to her father, Tsar Nicholas II. For 5 decades and across 2 continents, Anastasia led an erratic, gypsy-like existence. From Ward B in Dahldorf, Miss Unknown moved into the large Berlin apartment of Baron Arthur von Kleist on May 30th, 1922. Her stay lasted but a few months. Berlin at the time was a strange amalgam of bizarre nightclubs, mystical organizations, and estranged nobility. Anastasia soon found that the von Kleist wanted to show her off like a prized pig. Anna ran away and was discovered at the Berlin Zoo, sleeping among the animals. She was next housed at Funkenmühl at the country home of police inspector Grunberg. Mrs. Grunberg was very hospitable. It was really lovely out there in the country, and they did everything they could to make my stay pleasant, she later wrote. Grunberg was intrigued by the mystery of the self-proclaimed noblewoman and decided to put Anastasia to a test. Princess Irene, one of Anastasia's many aunts, was brought to the home for dinner and introduced to Anastasia as a Grunberg relative. Feeling betrayed and unfairly tested, she returned to the von Kleist household. Soon thereafter, she was diagnosed with tuberculosis and admitted to the West End Hospital at Charlottenburg. And it's interesting to note that Charlottenburg is probably named for the same person that Charlottesville is named for. Okay. Miss Unknown remained there through the end of 1923. When released from the hospital, Anastasia moved into the dingy apartment of a new friend, Clara Puthert. When this friendship failed, Anna was taken in by a poor family of coal carriers who were unaware of her claim to royalty. Because of her deteriorating physical condition, Grunberg took her back to Funkenmühl, but soon lost patience when she wasn't recognized by the former German crown princess, Sicily of Prussia. St. Mary's Hospital in Berlin became her next home. On July 28, 1925, Anastasia was transported to the Mommsen nursing home to have surgery on a tuberculosis-infected arm. Almost a year later, Anna moved into the Hotel Tivoli in Lugano, Switzerland, to convalesce. She was accompanied by Mrs. Harriet Ratlev, an extremely close friend and supporter. True to her painfully repeating cycle, this relationship soured when Miss Unknown fell into depression and turned on Harriet. From Switzerland, she was taken to the Stillachhaus Sanatorium in the Bavarian Alps. Her poor condition dictated that she remain at least 1 year. From the Stillachhaus, Anna was moved to Castle Sion in Upper Bavaria. Her new protector was Duke George of Luchtenburg, who had helped negotiate the German peace with Russia at Brest-Litovsk. The castle and grounds at Sion were filled with an eclectic collection of mismatched furniture and fake statuary. Anastasia remained at Sion through the fall of 1927. I was laughing because I think that fake statuary would be a good environment for Anastasia. Gleb Botkin, son of the Tsar's personal physician, visited from the United States, then returned to drum up new believers and new supporters. Anastasia's next benefactor was Mrs. William B. Leeds, the former Princess Xenia Georgievna of Russia, The real Anastasia and Xenia were second cousins, and the two had played together as children. Xenia had married an American heir to a tin fortune. On February 1st, 1928, Miss Unknown boarded the Berengaria with a six-month visa for her first trip to the United States. In the port of New York, Anastasia was mobbed by reporters. They blockaded her cabin door and flashed hundreds of photos as she stepped onto the pier. Gleb Botkin escorted Anastasia through the crowd and whisked her off to the Park Avenue home of Annie Burr Jennings. Miss Jennings was a descendant of Aaron Burr and the well-heeled daughter of a director of Standard Oil. In this posh environment of American nobility, she was given the grand treatment and introduced into the highest New York social circles, as you can imagine. This day lasted a few weeks until the Leeds returned from a West Indies cruise. Mr. and Mrs. Leeds owned Kenwood, a beautiful 54-acre estate on Oyster Bay, Long Island. There, Anastasia was put up in her own suite and was given a set of parrots. The real Grand Duchess's love of animals had been well publicized. At first glance, the arrangement at Kenwood seemed ideal. Anastasia had the run of the place, and her physical condition was improving. The situation soured, however, when Gleb Botkin and Mrs. Leeds strongly disagreed on how best to handle the Grand Duchess's affairs. Relying on Gleb's advice, Anastasia moved into the Garden City Hotel on Long Island. Gleb's friends provided the funds, and Gleb provided the company. Here was begun perhaps the one true friendship of Miss Unknown's lifetime. After all, how could she not trust a man whose father had sworn allegiance to her fantasy family and had died because of it? On January 1929, Anastasia moved back into the Park Avenue apartment of Miss Jennings. There, Annie Jennings and her secretary attended to Miss Unknown's every wish. The Imperial Princess also became an integral part of Miss Jennings's hectic social life. In early 1930, however, Anastasia's black mood returned, and she retreated into the seclusion of her room with her mementos. Once again, an avid supporter was lost because of the Grand Duchess's erratic behavior. Annie Jennings arranged to have Anastasia judged legally insane and committed to Four Winds Sanatorium in Westchester County, New York. There, Miss Jennings provided Anastasia with her own suite and attendant. In the height of the Great Depression, the Jenningses spent thousands on the woman who claimed to be the Grand Duchess Anastasia. When the expense proved too much, however, Anastasia was put on board the German ship Deutschland under the care of a Finnish nurse. She had exhausted the patience of her American well-wishers. Her first stay in the United States was over. During the journey at sea, her Finnish escort kept Anastasia locked in her stateroom. When the Deutschland arrived in Germany in late August of 1931, Anastasia was escorted to the Kurenstalt Ilten, a psychiatric home just outside of Hanover. The nurse saw to it that Anastasia was properly admitted, in the process telling the doctors that her charge was completely mad. Then the nurse disappeared. An examination soon thereafter convinced the specialists that there was no need to institutionalize her, but Anastasia decided to remain well into 1932. On leaving Ilton, Anna once again sought help from Harriet Ratliff. Harriet brought her back to Berlin and set her up in a respectable pension where Anastasia could hold court. At the center of Berlin society, the self-proclaimed lost princess had two of her happiest years. Harriet died in 1934 of breast cancer, and Anastasia began to slip back into darkness. A nervous breakdown followed in 1935. During this period of her life, Anastasia flitted around Germany from one friend to another, as if the flittering we'd seen already wasn't enough. In her travels, she accumulated a huge collection of imperial family knickknacks. From Berlin, she journeyed to Hanover, Starnberg in Bavaria, and then Pomerania and Westphalia. From there, the Grand Duchess toured the Palatinate, Hesse, Thuringia, and Saxony. Anastasia's visits were usually unannounced. Her stays were often short. Her benefactors were either of the German or Russian aristocracy. A good number of these were believers in, and I thought this was really bizarre, Anthroposophy, a mystical science that tied the sweeping changes of cultures and peoples to cosmic influences, something that probably Archie Challoner also believed in. Some of the followers saw Anastasia as the soul of Russia, in touch with the land and the people who worked it. Her most important benefactor at this period was Baroness Monica Miltitz, a leader of the Anthroposophists. The Baroness often gave Anastasia the use of the family castle just outside of Meissen. With the advent of World War II, Anastasia's life in Germany became more erratic and more difficult. As Russian forces invaded Germany at the end of the war, Anastasia's friends naturally feared for her life. The descendants of the Bolsheviks would most certainly want her dead. To avoid the advancing Reds, the Grand Duchess was escorted to the tiny Black Forest village of, and this one is really tough, Unterlegenheit, where she was placed in a clinic. A military barracks was purchased, and Anastasia moved in with her many precious family heirlooms. An older woman by the name of Adele Heidebrand became her live-in caretaker and companion. As Adele was aware of Anna's mood swings and was capable of handling them, the two became fast friends. The villagers were at first skeptical of the self-proclaimed noblewoman living among them. As many of them were anthroposophists, however, they eventually came to accept and even revere her. In the Black Forest, Anastasia was finally able to settle down. Unterlegenheit would be her home until 1968, when she moved to Charlottesville, Virginia. At Unterlegenheit, she suffered through two German court cases that attempted to establish her rightful identity. Both of these failed. From this village, too, Anastasia watched in horror as her fantasy life was portrayed on the stage and on the silver screen. This kind of publicity, of course, did little to convince the general public of the veracity of her phony claims. It was at Unterlegenheit also that Anastasia settled into the life of a recluse. After Adele died, there were other caretakers and supporters, but none could control her. Anastasia loved being surrounded by hundreds of mementos of the real imperial family. They brought her comfort and reassurance. Friends collected them and sent them to her by the mail. These were hung on the walls and stacked in piles until only narrow paths were left connecting the rooms. Her love of animals became an obsession and the object of serious concern in the neighborhood. Literally dozens of dogs and cats roamed her quarters and her grounds at will. She loved them, but would not train or scold them. One can well imagine how quickly a horde of unruly animals can disrupt a living environment. Visitors and villagers were often forced to speak with Anastasia from the other side of her fence. That is, when she would speak to them. When it became obvious that the legal system in Germany would never proclaim her as the real Grand Duchess, and when the situation in Unterlegenheit began to endanger her physical and mental health, it was decided to bring her to the United States, to Charlottesville, Virginia. Gleb Bodkin had for years been living in a cottage in New Jersey where he had set up the Church of Aphrodite. His daughter Marina had married a lawyer, Richard Schweitzer, and the two had settled in Charlottesville. When a fire destroyed Gleb's home, he decided to move to the quiet Central Virginia town to be with his family. In Charlottesville, Gleb made the acquaintance of Dr. John Jack Manahan. Jack's father had been a well-regarded professor at the University of Virginia. Jack was a professor of history and political science and an avid genealogist. He was also fairly wealthy. Manahan became enthralled with Anastasia's life and peculiar situation and offered his financial assistance. Anastasia's supporters in Germany convinced her to leave. Anastasia, the pretend Grand Duchess of Imperial Russia, arrived in Charlottesville July 13th, 1968. She had just turned 67. Gleb and Alexis Mulikov, another close supporter and fellow Russian, accompanied Anastasia to Manahan's home at number 35 University Circle, just off of Rugby Road. Miss Unknown had initially hoped that Manahan would purchase for her a hotel that would then become her source of income. Everyone was soon amazed, however, at how well the Grand Duchess and her new American friend got along. They were married on December 23rd, 1968, in a simple civil ceremony. For Anastasia, it was a marriage of convenience. It granted her legal right to remain in the United States with her new protector. There can be no doubt, however, that over the years she grew fond of and even loved Jack Manahan. She needed him. For Jack's part, it was a pretend dream come true. What better life for a genealogist than to be married to the woman who said she was the Grand Duchess of Russia? Mrs. William Stevens of Charlottesville was heard to comment that Jack loved history and eventually married a piece of it. In his mind, Manahan's mind, with this marriage, he became a Romanov. Anastasia lived in Charlottesville until she died of natural causes on February 12, 1984. The Grand Duchess and her husband, her junior by 18 years, became alternately famous and then notorious in Central Virginia circles. Jack's money and ties to the university granted them access to the most prominent of Charlottesville's elite. As they grew older and more difficult to deal with, however, and as Jack's efforts to publicize his wife became more and more bizarre, they sensed the community distancing itself. The Manahans responded in kind. The residents on University Circle, once opulent, took on the appearance of the filthy, cluttered barracks home in Unterlegenheit. In a town known for its eccentrics, Jack and Anastasia Manahan were the most bizarre. When Anna was buried in the university cemetery, Central Virginia headlines announced, "The Tsarina of Charlottesville is dead." In a strange sense, it seemed fitting that Anastasia would pass her last days in Charlottesville, Virginia, a town sought by many as a refuge. Until his passing on March 22, 1990, Jack Manahan would tell all those who would listen of his believed association by marriage to Tsar Nicholas II, last imperial monarch of Russia. But what made Anastasia's supporters through the years so sure of her royal identity? Why had so many, after a brief audience, been willing to proclaim her the Grand Duchess? The reasons are numerous, and yet there were individuals of power and Romanov family connections that did just that. Why? The strange case of Madame Tchaikovsky intrigued all of Europe. Once her story was published in the newspapers, imperial family members and acquaintances of the actual princess came to see her and proclaim their yay or nay. Anastasia's life was a circus of the bizarre. At St. Mary's Hospital, Anna was visited by Russian Dr. Sergei Rudnev. In 1914, on the day war with Germany was declared, the real Grand Duchesses Anastasia and Tatiana were throwing wadded paper balls at Rudnev as he passed the royal palace. When Rudnev asked her if she remembered that momentous day, she said, "My sister and I were pelting the passers-by with little paper balls." She was also visited at St. Mary's by the real Anastasia's former nursemaid, Alexandra Teglova, whom the Romanovs had nicknamed Shura. The Romanov girls were plagued by genetically malformed feet. The balls of the feet jutted out, giving the large toes a rather strange look. In one of her moods, Miss Unknown would not speak to the former nanny, but Shura pulled back the bed covers and immediately recognized a similar deformity. During another visit by the former nursemaid, Anastasia grabbed Shura's hand, poured cologne into it, and asked Shura to apply it to her forehead. Shura smiled. This had been an indulgence that the actual Grand Duchess often asked for in her childhood. After examining the lost princess for other identifying physical characteristics, including a mold that had been burned off her shoulder and a scar on one finger, Shura proclaimed, "This is Anastasia's body." How had the pretender Anastasia known these facts, and how is it that she had the same body marks? We'll probably never know. The real Anastasia's Aunt Olga visited in 1925. Olga Alexandrovna, Grand Duchess of Russia, was Nicholas's sister, daughter of the Dowager Tsarina. Olga, her sister Xenia, and the Tsarina had been living in Denmark in semi-poverty. Olga traveled from Denmark to visit with Miss Unknown at Mommsen for 3 days. She was accompanied by Shura, the former nanny, and Pierre Gilliard, who had tutored the real Romanov princesses in French. Careful notes were taken of what transpired between the two women. Anastasia was pale, weak, and bedridden at the time. When the well-dressed older Grand Duchess sat on her bed, Anastasia's face lit up. She appeared to recognize Olga, and more importantly, Olga seemed to recognize her as her niece. Gilliard was also convinced, saying that he would consecrate the rest of his life to serving His Imperial Highness. The room was filled with a happy sense of reunion. Witnesses believed that this was the event the ersatz Grand Duchess had longed for. A few years later, Gleb Botkin would write that now her greatest wish to be taken to her grandmother, the Dowager Empress Maria Fyodorovna, would at last be fulfilled. Olga and Anastasia chatted in private. Miss Unknown later described a conversation in which Olga lamented that the revolution had deprived the Romanov family of its wealth. Anastasia told Olga not to worry. Tsar Nicholas, she said, had deposited a large sum in a British bank to be used as dowry money. Now it was Aunt Olga that was transformed, witnesses said. She became noticeably cooler. Perhaps this expatriate Russian noblewoman, who had been reduced to painting portraits for a living, began then and there to plot for the money. The doctors had told her that Anastasia was dying. With the woman who pretended to be her niece gone, the Grand Duchesses Olga and Xenia, along with their mother, the Tsarina, would become principal heirs. Olga returned to Denmark to report her findings to the other Romanovs. A card arrived soon after with the following message: "You are not alone, and we will not abandon you." But abandon her they did. After a short period of silence on the subject, Grand Duchess Olga and Mr. Gilliard began to assure everyone that Anastasia was an imposter. A short time later, Olga's sister, Xenia, instituted herself through the British court as legal heir to all the funds the late Russian emperor may be found in England. A German newspaper ran a series of articles claiming that Anastasia was in fact a deranged Polish woman by the name of Franciszka Szanskowska. The Hesse-Darmstadt police even attempted to issue her a passport under that name. Anastasia made a revelation during the same period that caused her never-ending trouble. She remarked casually to Harriet Ratlev that she desired to see her uncle, the Grand Duke Ernst Ludwig of Hesse-Darmstadt, since she had last seen him in Russia during the war. The Grand Duke was brother of the real Anastasia's mother, Tsarina Alexandra, but more importantly during the war had been a member of the German general staff. When the Grand Duke heard of this comment, he flew into a rage. Rumors had circulated in Russia that the Grand Duke had visited his sister in an unsuccessful attempt to obtain for Germany a separate peace. No one, however, had stepped forward to actually verify this claim. If the Grand Duke had been in Russia in 1916, it was against the explicit prohibition of the German High Command. But if Anastasia was an imposter, how had she been privy to this information? Gleb Botkin later concluded that the persecution of the phony Anastasia was orchestrated by her uncle. Mr. Gilliard had been retained by Grand Duke Ernst Ludwig as a representative, and the editor of the German newspaper was heard to boast that he worked closely with the Grand Duke. At the Stillichhaus Sanatorium in Oberstdorf, Anastasia was put through an extensive physical examination. She was also closely watched through all of her many mental dispositions. The doctors concluded that her whole nature was so distinctive and so thoroughly refined that one must, without knowing anything at all about her origins, recognize her as the offspring of an old, highly cultured, and in our opinion, extremely decadent family. It is absolutely out of the question that this woman is deliberately playing the part of another. Even in the Central Virginia town of Charlottesville, opinion was and still is divided as to her authenticity. Mr. William Stevens and his wife still have their doubts. They were acquainted with Audrey Emery of Cincinnati, whose first husband had been Grand Duke Paul, one of Rasputin's assassins. Audrey was convinced that Anastasia was a fraud because of her guttural German, she spoke. No daughter of the Tsar, who was carefully tutored in languages, would dare to speak a low form of German. Mr. Stevens himself says that he never felt comfortably sure that she was the real thing. Mildred Ewell, however, a neighbor and longtime friend of the Manahans, has no trouble endorsing Anastasia's claims. The frail woman she first met on University Circle in 1968 carried herself with an imperial air. She was a little aloof, reticent, and very reserved. Almost like a southern lady who was to the manor born, Miss Unknown was very prim and proper and very straight-laced. There seemed to be no reason to doubt her word. She was who she said she was. In 1991, the remains of the Romanovs were taken out of a pit near the industrial town of Ekaterinburg, Siberia. Genetic testing has identified Nicholas, Alexandra, and three Grand Duchesses. A piece of Anastasia's tissue that had been preserved at Martha Jefferson Hospital since an early operation was DNA tested against the bone fragments brought up from that grisly mass burial. And the results? What was the answer to the imperial mystery that had captivated the world since 1920? Anastasia, the lost fantasy princess who had bounced around the world claiming she was the rightful heir to the remaining Romanov riches, was not related to the Romanovs. It appears that the German newspaper had been right all along. Imagine that. Anastasia Manahan, Fräulein Unbekannt, Miss Unknown, Madame Tchaikovsky, was probably, actually, Franziska Szanskowska, a deranged Polish woman with a thirst for fame and a mind full of an unbelievable amount of detailed information about the actual imperial family. Where and how had she acquired it? Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.